Okay, change pace a little bit now, looking forward.
So we'll move on to agenda paper 14, 14A to 40C, about lack of exchange ability. So these papers discuss possible narrow scope standard setting, about the exchange rate an entity uses when exchangeability between two currencies is lacking. The purpose of today's session is to ask whether you agree with our recommendation on the scope and on the content of any amendment. Our analyses and recommendations in these papers incorporate the feedback that you provided on this matter at your November 2018 meeting. We'll start with agenda paper 14, which includes our analysis and recommendation about a possible standard setting approach for this project. Paragraph 11 to 18 discuss possible standard setting approaches. Paragraph 19 explains why we think the committee should consider more broadly when exchangeability is lacking and develop requirements on the exchange rate an entity uses in those circumstances. I will now direct your attention to the question on page 7 of agenda paper 14 and ask whether you agree with our recommendation.
I concur with the staff perspective and proceeding on the basis as outlined in the cover memo.
Yeah, I also agree. I think the going down alternative B is likely to provide more utility out of the conclusions and the guidance. I'm in the same place as Reinhardt.
Does anybody disagree with
good question.
Looking for efficiency and standardization and all opportunity? No?
So now we move over to agenda paper 14A. So this paper set out our analysis and recommendation on how to define exchangeability and thus lack of exchangeability. Paragraph 14 to 83 present our analysis in this respect, including any refinements we made to the preliminary views that we presented last November. In particular, our analysis now incorporates the consideration of normal administrative delays. This is addressed specifically in paragraph 16 to 24 of agenda paper 14A. Also, as explained in paragraph 36 to 38 of this paper, we have refined our analysis with regards to the means of accessing foreign currency. Paragraph 84 to 85 summarizes our recommendation on this respect. I will now direct your attention to the question on page 19 of the paper and ask whether you agree with our recommendations.
Am I allowed to make a comment?
Yes.
Oh, because I get to say. Yes, I'll allow myself to make a comment. Benefit of being the chair. I guess I just, and it's not a personal view, it's just sharing some feedback that I got because I had the opportunity to present what we're looking at here at the Emerging Economies Group meeting a little while ago in Argentina. And as you would imagine, they're very interested in this topic, in South America in particular. One of the points that they were very focused on was this criteria about which market you can access. And at the time I was explaining what was in our old papers, and even based on what we had in those old papers, they were somewhat concerned that this focus on legal accessibility was too narrow, and we've probably tightened it up based on the feedback we got from the committee relative to that. And I guess what I took away from the conversation there was that I think they were concerned that perhaps we were bringing in some sort of moral judgment in terms of whether we agreed with what people were doing or not, as opposed to accounting concepts. I think that was underlying some of their thoughts. At the time, I was focusing on explaining to them what I understood from our previous version of this, which was really we were trying to focus on whether or not the transaction could be unwound. I think, yeah, I think they were more comfortable with that focus as long as we were clear that that was what the sort of test was, if you like, although still not thrilled. So I suspect that they'd probably not be too keen with our direction of travel. So just to give that feedback, because I think it's something the board will need to think about as well when we get to have a look at it. I guess I would concern there might be too many markets that people actually were using in practice that might be blocked if we were too restrictive here, and I wondered if that was appropriate or not. So I don't know whether any reactions.
And I would echo that.
Guy.
Maybe on that, I guess the concern would have with that, maybe this is inherent in the enforceability point, but I would be concerned about predicating my rate on a market that is not legally accessible, because I don't know that I'll actually be able to access that market, and so that's fundamentally my concern in allowing a rate that comes from a market that's not legally accessible. But maybe the enforceability notion is about that. But to me, they're kind of one and the same. If it's not legally accessible, then in my mind, I can't understand how I could ever enforce my ability to go get the rate that I used.
Andrew?
Thanks. One on the legal rates, I have similar concerns, so I won't repeat what Guy just said very nicely. The other thing, and if it's dealt with somewhere in the paper and I've missed it, my apologies. One thing that occurred to me when I looked at 14A was, what if an entity was able to convert some currency at one rate and some currency at another rate? So in the example where you've got 1,000 of functional currency, it could do 400 at one rate and it could get 600 at another rate. What would I do then? Now, I presume I would use the rate I can get for each bit, but I wasn't sure that was covered explicitly, and we might want to cover that.
Okay. Young Su?
I agree with the staff analysis conclusion, but I have one question which I think you might not be able to answer. But my question is, how big or small the insignificant amount is. Definitely, based on the example you gave us, it's much lower than 40%. But how much lower than 40% when we decide whether the significant amount is?
I'd say that it is a matter of judgment.
Yeah, similar to the concept in other IFRS standard, we just say that's a matter of judgment. I mean, other IFRS standard don't define those amounts as well, so.
Pretty small.
It should be pretty small. Yeah. Very small.
Bruce?
Thanks. I just want to make a comment on this legality issue. I mean, that's something that has been raised a number of times before from the markets. I mean, just a couple of things on that. Firstly, to point out that generally this kind of issue normally happens in less developed markets. I mean, we don't see this in the very developed markets. So for some of you, exposure to whether you're talking about legal or illegal is a black or white decision, and it's not. There are a lot of situations where the law is silent on things like asset swaps or those type of situations which companies are using. And I just think that for us to be, I've got a feeling that if we put in that legally just as it is, I can tell you we're going to get pushback, because a lot of people are going to start saying, well, now you need to start defining what do you mean by legally accessible. And remember, what's legal in one country may be legal in my country, but it's illegal in another country. Now, do I need to take the other country's laws into account when I'm doing an asset swap potentially? And these type of things do create a very, very practical problem for people moving forex. I like what you said about the focus and where the transaction can be reversed. I think, to me, if we could try and build something, I don't know if it's exactly that wording, but something more around has the transaction happened? Nobody else can reverse it. You've now got your currency at that rate. Those are the kind of things I'd look at. I mean, I'm not advocating to say we should go in there and say we can use illegal methods, but I just think that this is not a black or white legal or illegal question. There's a mass amount, and especially in the type of markets who will be applying this, that are very, very grey. And I think you're right. We just put this hard stop in. It's going to be very, very practical.
I think if we focus on what it is that we care about, like why the sort of can it be reversed type notion, I think it helps in two ways. Firstly, we're not sort of relying on a a distinction based on a word like legal versus illegal, which might be hard to judge in different countries, but also I don't think that it has been coming from us trying to say we don't want to, I don't know, encourage people or, you know, to use illegal mechanisms. And by focusing on this sort of enforceability, reversibility, it's making it clear it's not a moral thing or a sort of judgment,
absolutely,
sort of moral judgment thing. It's a, we care for a sort of economic reason. And if we could reinforce that, I think that might help with messaging as well.
So if I understand, maybe it's moving away from having to get at legal or illegal and maybe somehow describing this more as maybe, I don't know, like, is there a genuine transaction or something, something to enforce?
Something like that.
Something economic. Permissible and enforceable.
Bonnie? Do you want to respond specifically, Guy? We're going to let you in.
It's not just important. It has to be accessible. Like, so if I'm basing it on some, you know, mechanism or arrangement today, that I'm not actually going and getting that rate today, but, you know, I think I might do it tomorrow or the next day, I have to be comfortable that that is accessible to me, and it, you know, once I've done it, it's not going to be unwound. So I think it's both accessibility and enforceability. And so that's why I personally like the notion of legally accessible, but I can appreciate maybe that notion might convey, you know, other things in certain jurisdictions. But the important thing in my mind is accessibility, and you know, to Sue's point, that you just can't be unwound. But I have to be, you know, 100% confident I can go access that rate.
Bonnie, I'm guessing you might have something to say on this.
I think that can be entity-specific, so I do want to make sure that, which I think the staff has highlighted, that the entity has to take into consideration its specific facts and circumstances. So I understand the accessibility point, but if it's permissible and enforceable, in my mind, by default, it's accessible. So, I mean, I agree with Bruce that it's often gray. Something may not be explicitly permitted, but it is allowed. So maybe even permissible isn't the right word, but it's the enforceability. But I mean, if a transaction, if a company has a legal letter from external counsel saying, yes, it's legal, then perhaps that meets the legal, but I completely understand Bruce's point in terms of kind of the grayness. I would propose to take out legal and add something that we can all live with. I had a similar comment on E, on the more than insignificant amount in the example. I would prefer not to put an example in because I think that implies a threshold, which... So maybe that was for the purposes of the paper, which
exactly.
Is fine.
Yeah.
But I want to make sure that we don't imply a threshold when that's not what we mean, because I think it's very judgmental. And again, entity and circumstance and fact specific. And then I'll reiterate, and I recognize that the staff did acknowledge that I have raised before, and it has been raised before, that there can be challenges from a system perspective with multiple rates, and I will continue to reiterate that because it is a challenge. And so I just, from a practical application perspective, I want to make sure that that is recognized.
Okay. Tony?
So I think I share probably Guy's concerns around where we end up with legality, enforceability, or whatever. I have no objection to not using the word legal or illegal, as long as we get the notion that the arrangement is enforceable and from the perspective of the entity can be accessed. I also had a couple of thoughts about the unable to obtain more than an insignificant amount. And probably three observations to think about. Unable to obtain more than an insignificant amount is a mouthful. And translated, it's probably going to be an even bigger mouthful. And I just wonder if there's another way. I don't know what it is, but I just wonder if there is a plainer English way of expressing the notion. The second is, it's more of a practical question about unit of account. So if I've got 1,000 payables of varying amounts, is the more than an insignificant amount by reference to the aggregate of my 1,000 payables or by reference to each of my 1,000 payables? Maybe one to ponder the after an answer now. And the last thing is maybe as the analysis goes on, just pausing to say, well, how often would this give a different answer to using a blended rate? Because I think the next paper suggests there might be a lot of circumstances where even if you concluded you couldn't get a more than insignificant amount, you might end up saying, well, actually, the best evidence I've got is the rate that I can get a less than insignificant amount at. So I'm comfortable with where the staff have ended up. I just thought this was a very good paper. But just a couple of things to think about as it moves forward.
If it's helpful to explain on the sort of transaction thing, I think at least, or thinking and writing the paper, is that it's at an individual transaction level, as certainly when you're thinking about, you know, translating into the functional currency. So I only say that to be clear about at least the background that we were thinking about here, so that if people, you know, think otherwise...
I think we need to think carefully about that, though, because I can see why we want people to think about, I don't know, imports of medicines versus, I don't know, buying stationery as two different transactions, because you might get a different answer. But I'm not sure we'd want to get to a different situation just because I did my medical transactions and 20 small transactions versus one big one that I'd want to go through. So maybe we need to think about grouping by transactions that have got the same sort of characteristics or something. But I think unit of account does matter, so we need to think about that.
Yeah. And maybe, as you said, it's linked to if you get a particular exchange rate for a particular type of transaction,
maybe think
of all the... Yeah.
I think we just need to think about the pros and cons of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Both operationally, probably, but also do you want a different outcome depending on that?
Yeah.
Bertrand?
I agree with the staff analysis and conclusion. I mean, I totally acknowledge what you've said, Sud. Obviously, I don't have any objection to that. Just for the sake of clarity, because, sorry, but you were a bit too subtle for me in the language. So what you're saying is that if a grey market is illegal but tolerated, then it would be fine to refer to a grey market. And if it's illegal but not tolerated, then it wouldn't be. Is it what we're hinting there?
Let Vincent respond.
Just to be crystal clear.
He's looking at me nervously in case I say the wrong things. He's thought about it much harder than I have.
100% crystal clear. Because,
safer that Vincent responds.
Tolerating market, we wandered through this option at the last meeting, and many among yours were sceptical about that notion of being tolerated, grey market, etc. But I think that if we switch the focus on which market is creating enforceable rights and obligations, would be the appropriate way of phrasing that. Just be, instead of saying it's tolerated, half prohibited, etc., I think that focusing on what is creating enforceable right and obligation would be a more objective assessment.
Awesome. Guy.
I was just going to pick up on the unit of account point that Tony raised. That was an issue that struck me as well, but it struck me that, you know, what might make sense there may depend on how the local market works in terms of accessing foreign currency, and that could influence how one might approach that question. But that also sort of caused me to think, maybe more broadly about the circumstances on the ground in different jurisdictions where this could potentially be relevant are likely to vary quite widely. And well, the approach here is seems imminently logical and whatnot. You know, one never really knows until it's employed on the ground somewhere, and so I don't know if there's a means of getting some more direct feedback around the operational aspects of this in real circumstances, and then with that you could build in some of these some solutions to unit of account and or ideas around how to address that.
Mary?
Just wanted an observation about Tony's remark about is it that different from a blended, I think Tony you were saying, would it be that different from a blended rate? As a style kind of approach point, I encourage the committee to focus on articulating what the objective is and being as clear as possible. And, you know, this issue about legal, illegal is a good one. You know, and Sue's encouragement to bring out what are the characteristics that you care about most. I think if you try too hard to be helpful in terms of saying, well, there's this, but then blended rate might often, and I think better to just set up the objective and then allow people to make a determination. You know, Bonnie, you said multiple rates are a pain. Well, if you have a clear objective, an entity can then decide how much granularity they need to satisfy that objective rather than trying to write lots of mechanics in it. It begins to be trying to be helpful education material, and then you end up putting in lots of things that people then start to arbitrate. So I'd say focus on what the characteristics are, keep it as simple as possible. And then if somebody says, well, really, that rate is the best starting point I have to meet this objective, or I'm going to use a blended rate because I think that will be a reasonable, you know, estimate of X, they can make that decision. But we won't have conflicting detailed guidance in something because this is going to be applied in a lot of circumstances. We don't, you know, we can't envisage right now.
I agree with that. I think my point in saying managing the multiple rates within a period.
Yeah.
Because if the rates change either by what market is accessible at a given point in time, but if you have, and I very much agree with what Tony was saying, if you've got individual transactions, which if they're sequential, maybe you can do that because it's like, you know, mm-hmm. if you manage a daily rate, that's feasible within a system. But if it's, you know, this set of transactions is this set of transactions is this set of transactions is this, and it's all kind of, you know, how you measure at a given point in time, that's extremely challenging for any system to manage. Now, thankfully, there's the materiality concept. but I think we need to be careful on what the objective is that we set. And if it's the objective is to get as close as possible to the exact rate, that's one thing. If it's to get to an approximate rate to give the best and most useful information to a user, to me, you end up with two different kind of objectives. And from a practical application perspective, my view is that we should focus on what's the best rate that approximates the economic situation as of a given point in time. And if a company says that's by using 10 different rates and they can manage that, fine. If it's using one rate across everything because that's what a company can manage and that makes sense given their facts and circumstances, that's fine. That's my view.
Right.
Move
to 14B.
So this paper presents our analysis and recommendation on the spot exchange rate that we
should use when a currency's exchangeability is lacking.
Paragraph 11 to 13 outline the main changes to our preliminary views.
In particular, we think it is not necessary to define temporary or long-term lack of exchangeability. Instead, we think the committee should develop requirements that would apply when currency is not exchangeable. these requirements would build on the principle in IS 21 to use a spot exchange rate at the reporting date or at the date of the transaction. Paragraph 14 to 19 discuss our proposed approach, and paragraph 20 to 52 discuss how entities would apply that approach. Paragraph 33 summarizes our recommendations. I will now direct your attention to the question on page 17 and ask whether you agree with our recommendations.
I agree with the staff proposal to not focus on defining temporary versus long-term, but just focus on lack of exchangeability. So with the change in direction in the paper, I'm very much on side with that. I think that'll be helpful.
Thank you. Bonnie?
The one comment I have is in, let me find it, if the requirement, and I think this is probably in current gap, but using the first subsequent rate at which exchanges could be made if exchangeability is restored before financial statements are authorized for issue, it creates a practical challenge. Because if I think about my Q2 reporting, my period ends June 30. If by some miracle the rate is restored and, you know, something happens by July 30th, my, let's say in the worst case scenario, my earnings release was July 28th, and I plan to furnish to my regulator, the SEC or whoever, on August 1st, what do I do? Do I update my financial statements because technically it's before they are issued, even though I've given results? Which I understand could happen for a subsequent event, and so I'm not suggesting that there isn't a situation where there could be something, but I find that a little bit problematic from a practical perspective. And if I've said as of June 30th, this is the date and this is the best rate that reflects the economic situation as of that date, if I think about my adjusting versus my non-adjusting subsequent event, I would suggest that I wouldn't adjust the rate and I would update it in the subsequent period because that reflects something that's happened after the period end. So just as I'm, you know, reading everything, that has come out very clearly to me from a just a practical application preparer perspective.
Bertrand?
Yeah, the way, maybe just for the sake of clarity, but yeah. So we were at the last meeting, we were requiring, well, to use the first subsequent exchange rate in the situation that you described, and many, well, some of you raised that specific concerns, and we changed the recommendation in that respect, and now we say that the first exchange rate at which a transaction could be made can be used as an indicator of the exchange rate at the reporting date, but we, in no case, we are requiring entities to use that rate. This is a piece of evidence that you might or might not consider, depending on the indicators that we have laid out in the paper, but in no case, we would require.
Okay. So it's very important. We're only permitting it, but
permitting,
not
but not requiring. Okay. Yeah, then I do agree. That maybe I missed that when I was reading. That is an important distinction.
And Bodhi, from a practical perspective, what I would do as a practitioner is just see whether there is any significant lag between what I've estimated in my half-year accounts and using an estimated rate, the best I could estimate at the time I had to release my accounts. And then this one, which is observable. But I think, effectively, strengthening the fact that you need first to refer to something that is observable rather than just purely estimated, I think is effectively preferable in terms of practitioners. From a practitioner's perspective, if my estimate would be so different on a very significant transaction than the observable rates, then maybe...
But to me, that could be handled in a subsequent events disclosure without actually changing your financial statements.
Exactly.
That's my point. It's if I have to go back and basically restate my Q2, financial statements, earnings release, everything. I understand what you're saying. I think the way that, as Vincent clarified, I think that does.
It's fine to you.
Yes.
Okay. Bertrand?
No, I agree with the staff analysis and with the proposal. I enjoyed a lot the flowchart. I find the flowchart on page 18 very clear and a very good summary of the paper. And so it might be worthwhile considering incorporating these flowcharts within any amendments to the standard as an exhibit.
Explanation.
As an appendix or whatever. So I found it very useful.
Thank you. Young Su?
I have just one comment. My comment is that we have to clearly say that what we are proposing as the estimate rate is not the same as the spot rate in IAS 21. Spot rate is the one that we can translate into foreign currency. It means that we can get foreign currency with the spot rate. But estimate rate is not the one we can get. I mean, the foreign currency instantly or immediately. I think that is also related to what Mary suggested as the objective of this project. So that what we are trying to do with the estimate rate might not be the foreign currency that the company can immediately be obtained. Instead, we want to show some reasonable amount of foreign currency that the company can get with the reasonable, estimated rate. So I think we have to specifically state that in the project.
Guy?
The one thing, one additional thing I was struck by I was wondering aloud whether some thinking was warranted here was the objectives that we've expressed in terms of estimating the rate. We say we want to assume exchangeability had not been lacking. We could have done an orderly transaction, and it reflects economic conditions at the reporting date. And then I was looking at the example given in paragraphs 33 and 34 of the paper, where we utilize the free floating rate that was available for particular purposes for another purpose where it wasn't exchangeable. And on the surface that seemed logical, but then I started to pause and say, well, what's absent from that is, well, it kind of ignores the fact that it wasn't exchangeable for the other purpose. And so when I think about some other circumstances in IFRS, such as IFRS 13, where there's risk or uncertainty, it commands you to make an adjustment for that risk or uncertainty. And there is an element of uncertainty in this circumstance that we're not acknowledging in the rate we're selecting, because I literally can't access that rate. But I'm using the other rate I can access for a different purpose, but it ultimately isn't reflecting the inherent uncertainty I'm facing. And logic struck me that I should embed some sort of adjustment to that rate because of that inherent uncertainty. How I could ever go about doing that, I've no practical suggestions there. But it just it did cause me some pause on the objective and whether there was a missing element of the objective to sort of, given the uncertainty and risk.
Think about that. Okay. Move on to disclosure. Anything C?
So this paper includes our analysis and recommendation on the disclosures that an entity should provide when exchangeability is lacking. Paragraph 4 to 11 explain our overall approach for disclosures requirements. Paragraph 12 to 14 present a high-level disclosure objective for the proposed amendments. paragraph 15 to 25 present three specific disclosure objectives that would, in our view, provide a more granular application of the high-level disclosure objectives. These paragraphs also discuss specific information that an entity should disclose when necessary to meet those objectives. Paragraph 26 to 27 summarize our recommendations. I will now direct your attention to the question on page 8 and ask whether you agree with our recommendation.
I generally agree with the staff recommendations. The one thing I wasn't clear on is in paragraph 24C and similarly in paragraph 27C, where we talk about the sensitivity analysis showing how the statement of comprehensive income would have been affected by a reasonably possible change in the exchange rate. I was also wondering whether perhaps as important as the change in exchange rate, whether it would be important to highlight the different measurement basis that you might have used, like if in terms of coming up with an exchange rate. So if you had a different, you made a judgment as to which market perhaps you looked to or what the basis for determining the rate, you made that judgment and you came up with a rate showing fluctuation, the potential in that rate is important, but also what if you were other, because you made a judgment as to which, how you determine that rate, are there other reasonably possible choices you could have made from a measurement perspective that is helpful to illustrate sensitivity to the user?
So this is the judgment that you made to assess exchangeability or to assess, to determine the exchange rate?
It's the latter, yeah.
Okay.
The approach that you took to come up with the rate.
Exactly.
Okay.
Because I think we are requiring entities to disclose how they have made that judgment. I'm just worried if we start asking them for sensitivities on different markets that they could have used, are we then forcing them to almost look at all the possible exchange rates that they could have used and disclose sensitivities? I'm just worried, is that requirement almost too onerous for entities to disclose every possible rate that they could have used and what the effect of that would have been?
And that's not what I'm suggesting. I'm just suggesting that if there were reasonably possible other choices, yeah, and you made a judgment as to one, and using the other potential basis would have come up with a significantly different answer. It's important to highlight the judgment you made as to the choice of rate, but also potentially consider what is the implication of the finance statements had you chosen that other reasonably possible potential basis and the implications on the statements.
Bertrand?
Around still sensitivity analysis, but I will take probably another Rose and Reinhardt. I'm not a big fan of sensitivity analysis on that, because you're estimating a rate, you're providing qualitative information, quantitative information, so it means impacts already, and you're then producing an estimate, a sensitivity analysis, which is an estimated calculation on an estimate. I doubt it provides necessarily a very useful information. You have qualitative information, quantitative information, eventually description of the main aggregates that are impacted by this quantitative information you've provided. But the sensitivity analysis in itself, it does not provide a lot of evidence to anyone. I'm not sure these. I mean, what I fear is that it would be for a preparer. It might be some amount of work for an information that is fundamentally not that useful. Sometimes you provide sensitivity analysis because the standard requires a sensitivity analysis, so we do that. But it's just to say, The cash flows would have been reduced by 30% if the rate would have been reduced by 30%. So, I mean, it means it brings nothing specific on top of the quantitative information itself and the description on the main aggregates that are effectively impacted by the quantitative information. But there, the problem is you're using an estimated rate, and the sensitivity analysis is an estimate over an estimate. Honestly.
Maybe it's a good point to bring in Goro. Goro?
Thank you. Actually, that the I'd say that the user tend to love the sensitivity analysis.
For free.
But actually, that I agree with Bertrand's view. And at this particular situation, I think that from the user's point of view, what we need is that the estimated spot rate and also the exposure to that currency risk. So that I mean that the size of assets and liabilities to that currency, so that the foreign exchange position, as indicated in the paragraph 50, and we have these two variables on that. That the investors can estimate what would be the actual impact on the income statement from the one unit change of the currency. Anyway, that in this kind of situation, I would expect that the volatility of the exchange rate could be very large. Therefore, I don't think that the sensitivity analysis could provide very useful information to users. So, and if we have the estimated spot rate and also the exposure to that currency, that would be enough for the investors. And we can, we can judge that if there are several companies who have the exposure to that currency, that we can know that which company is more conservative and which company is more optimistic, or that. And anyway, that the users can use that the exchange rate, which they believe that the more proper or the more appropriate rate to reflect the economic substance of that particular country. And by doing so, that we can measure, as far as we have that the amount of assets and liabilities, we can have that we can estimate that the impact by assuming certain change in that possible change in that currency. Therefore, I don't think that the requiring sensitivity, which I suggest that would be very much onerous to the preparers, doesn't provide that the useful information to users compared to the cost to the preparers. Thank you.
May I ask a question to Goro? Can I ask you a question? Because I understand, sir, that the sensitivities about how the exchange rate affect the financial statement, well, is not providing much useful information for you. Mm-hmm. But in our proposed requirements, we also ask entities to disclose the sensitivity about the parameters that are used to determine the exchange rate. So, for instance, mm-hmm. if an entity decides to use the purchasing power theory to estimate the exchange rate, in that case, probably the entity would have to disclose a sensitivity analysis about the inflation rate that the entity used to determine that exchange rate. Is that kind of sensitivity analysis useful for you, or you think, well, you don't need that information? What matters most is just the figure that they worked out.
You are proposing that to make that the standard setting which can be applied to more, broader situation than the extreme situation like Venezuela. Mm-hmm. So that the, if this is the case, that the sensitivity might be useful, but the, I would say that the when the there is the lack of exchangeability, I believe that the, you know, the currency rate would be very volatile. And the, you know, the exercise on the sensitivity would require, you know, so many assumptions. And the, you know, this is my view, and the, I'm may not be the, I'm not, I may not be representing the larger community of the investors, but I'd say that the situation like this, when that the, there is a lack of exchangeability, I think that the estimate itself, that the estimate of the spot rate itself is very difficult, as you suggested in this paper. And the, so, you know, that the assumption itself is not very hard. Therefore, that the, you know, the sensitivity, you know, itself may not be reliable. So I think that the, you know, the some kind of a very rough assumptions that how much that the profit and loss could change if that the estimated spot rate change 10%, 20%, I think that is enough for the investors. I don't think that the, you know, change in the assumptions would create that the how much change in the spot rate does not provide useful information to the investors. That is my view.
I agree with Goro. I think that providing a sensitivity analysis on some variables that lead to an estimated rate, I can't see where the interest is, but if we ask to, we'll provide. But there are in many instances we provide such analysis, and I'm always struggling in understanding why we are doing that exactly, and what is really the interest for whom there is an interest.
I think we're going to do quite a bit of investor outreach on this, but I'm just conscious of time because we need to try and finalise our, hopefully, the tentative agenda decision on the IS7 question. So I want to try and wrap this up by about 22, if we could. Bruce?
Thanks. I was just going to come in on the other side. I mean, I appreciate for the preparers, this is a lot of work, which is why I can imagine you guys wouldn't want to do this, but I mean, to me, just to be consistent, I mean, if we require people to do sensitivities on IFRS 7, where we've kind of got known variables, I mean, to me, I would think the sensitivity would be even more crucial here. I mean, this, to me, is such a fundamental cornerstone of how you're preparing your accounts in terms of what rate you're using. I accept what Sue says, and I think you're right. I think there's going to be a lot of outreach in terms of, I'd be very interested in seeing what the other, especially the users of the financials, say. But as much as I do appreciate a lot of work on the one side, to me, this would be absolutely fundamental to my understanding of the impact.
To be very clear on that, and I think it's what Goro said, correctly understood him. I mean, if you provide an information that enable first the preparer and then the user to appreciate the FX risk exposure and the magnitude of the variability of this FX risk exposure depending on the potential evolution of the FX rate, I think that is sufficient. I mean, then providing a sensitivity analysis on the underlying assumptions that lead you to a specific rate, so isolating the inflation rate, the whatever rate, the I don't see where this is really interesting.
Because I think so that those are
maybe key. Maybe we're saying the same, I don't know, but yeah. I'm not saying we do not want to provide, it's not just a matter of taking time. I mean, if we have to do, we'll do. I mean, just
But really, is it interesting?
Well, I just
to understand that the inflation rate might vary by X percent. It will lead to a variation on the rate of X percent, and then it would lead to a variation on the liabilities of X percent. Is it really that you're asking for? Because that is of no interest. But if you think it's interesting, we'll provide it. But honestly, I can't see where it's interesting. What would be interesting, if I correctly understood Goro, is what is the magnitude of the potential variability on your overall FX risk exposure on key aggregates. This I understand. But then you need to assess not a single parameter that leads you to estimate the rates, but all parameters combined and the way... the combination of all those parameters, which is ultimately the estimated rate you've reached.
Look, I don't just one last comment on that. I was going to say, I'm not saying you do every parameter that goes into your estimate, but if there are some key ones that are so volatile, to me, I think it would be important. But I think let's see where that.
We'll do some outreach and we'll try and understand what investors are interested in and how they'll use the information, and that I think will be an important part of our process to. Supplement what we've heard from Goro already. Goro, you want to come back on?
Yes. As I said, I don't think that the calling the sensitivity analysis to three pillars do not, provide that the cost-effective information. But I do agree that the underlying assumptions which that the preparers, estimate the spotlight is very important. So that in addition to that estimated spotlight and also the exposure, the disclosing that the assumptions like inflation rate, etc., is a very useful information to users. But I doubt that if the sensitivity analysis would provide that the more benefit than cost to the preparers. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary?
Two different kinds of points. The first, the pick up on this exchange about sensitivity, because my overall reaction to this paper was, I think as we very often do, we're approaching this assuming that this is the most significant issue in the financial statement. So, and for some entities it may well be, but for others it may be one operation that it's material, but I did worry that it was maybe a bit of overkill to assume it's the extent to which you have to do in every circumstance. And I pick up on Goro's point that he wants to know that it's an estimated rather than an observed rate, wants to know what that rate is, and he wants to be able to understand the financial statement impact, the exposure, to the estimate of that rate. And as I think about that, I think understanding those points may be less sensitivity analysis of underlying estimates as laid out in paragraph B, 27B, and it may be more understanding some of the mechanics that we were talking about, the committee was talking about earlier in terms of what proportion of your, because you may not have used a single rate. What proportion is translated at, let's say, a rate you could use for medical or other necessary goods versus a rate that is for dividend distribution. So it's giving a high-level understanding of how, the overall rate breaks down so that if, Goro and his colleagues can look at it and say, A, this company is aggressive in terms of what they estimated the overall rate being. B, they've assumed that they can take everything out at the medical goods rate rather than at the, dividend distribution rate. And I think it's maybe more important to users to understand that than it is for users to understand the econometric modeling considerations that they use to develop that rate. So I think greater granularity about the mechanics, not every number, but greater granularity about the mechanics might be more important than some of the overall sensitivity. And, Goro, you said that generally users love sensitivity. I think this may be one of the instances in which they'd rather have high-level summary workings, I'm just betting this, high-level summary workings, rather than just a number that says plus, you know, plus or minus, here's what the impact would be. So maybe that, again, that's something to test in outreach. Second, very, very different category of comment, and it's more for the staff from a board member than to the interpretation committee. Paragraph 27C is drafted in a way that reflects some of the discussions we've been having about how do we operationalize the disclosure initiative drafting points. And it says, you know, the objective is basically disclose qualitative and quantitative info about the nature and extent of risk. We recommend that an entity disclose the following information. I think that we as a board are going to have to take a decision about whether it's a normally you'd have to or something you might want to consider. This is halfway house language. So I just want to flag that that's something that we're having ongoing discussions about at the board level. We haven't taken a decision yet.
Okay. Just a quick comment on the disclosure subject. I will also be very interested to hear what the investor outreach is, I guess maybe as a point of reference when we still had our Venezuelan operations consolidated in our financial statements. We disclosed the rate, kind of the history of the rates that we'd used at the different points in time and why. We disclosed what our net position was that was subject to the rate. And that would then allow sensitivity to be done by somebody saying, okay, if it's plus or minus 10%, or if we're using the gray market rate, which is readily available on the internet, what would it be? If we're using a different rate, what would it be? And that seemed to be sufficient. It wasn't the most material part of our business. It was obviously qualitative, so we did disclose it. But I think that is in line with what Goro was saying in terms of, in this particular situation, what would be helpful to an investor rather than, a very detailed analysis of how we came to the rate, what is the sensitivity of the different pieces of the rate. Now, that was an observable rate, not an estimated rate. If you use an estimate, perhaps there's maybe a little bit more you would need to disclose as to how, you know, the significant factors and how you came up with that rate. But
maybe just to add to Mary's point, sort of with my board member hat on, it's good. See, Catherine's in the room. as a declared objective-based disclosure skeptic, I guess I felt much more warm and fuzzy when I read paragraph 22 of the paper, where we're quite specific about the types of risks and information we might think is interesting to investors, than when I got to paragraph C in the last paragraph, when we go to this higher level. Both because I wonder whether it's both helpful sometimes for preparers to get a more specific instruction in terms of what sort of risk we mean and what sort of information we're thinking about, and whether we might get a better result for investors if we're more specific about what we're looking at. So when you bring it to the board, I'll be also focusing on how exactly we're wording this stuff and how confident I am that it's going to get a good result. But I think Mary's point on proportionality is also important. You know, how big a deal is it in the financials? We probably need to bring that out a little bit more. Okay. Got what you need?
Thank you.
Good segue into going back to IAS 7.